all to see in the back of the huge open Lincoln. At the Capitol, the ceremonial greetings inside the rotunda took longer than expected. By the time everyone was in place outside on the inaugural platform, by the time the invocation had been delivered by Dr. Edward Pruden of Washington's First Baptist Church, Truman's Church, the national anthem sung by tenor Phil Regan, and Alban Barkley, looking like an old Roman sworn in as vice president by Justice Stanley Reed, and another prayer spoken by Rabbi Samuel Thurman of the United Hebrew Congregation of St. Louis, it was approaching 12:30. Truman put aside his hat, scarf, and overcoat. He stood bareheaded in the wind, his right hand raised, a straight-backed, bespectacled figure with closely cropped gray hair, his expression deadly serious. Above him in the winter sun rose the immense white columns and dome of the Capitol. His wife and daughter and some 15 members of his family sat nearby among the highest officials of the land, many of whom he had known since first coming to Washington. And it was Chief Justice Vinson, his mop of gray hair blowing in the wind, who administered the 43-word oath, which Truman repeated slowly and clearly, his left hand on two Bibles, a large facsimile of the Gutenberg Bible, a gift from the people of Independence, and, on top, the same small Gideon edition that had served under such different circumstances on April 12, 1945. The oath completed, Truman, like Andrew Jackson at his inaugural, bent quickly and kissed the Bible. It was 1:29, and for the first time as president in his own right, he turned to face the microphones and the expectant crowd. "I accept with humility the honor which the American people have conferred on me. I accept it with a resolve to do all I can for the welfare of this nation and for the peace of the world." How strange the matter-of-fact Missouri twang had sounded in the spring of 1945 to a world familiar with another man's phrase and another man's diction, wrote one reporter. Today, for listeners everywhere, there was nothing strange about it. This simply was the president speaking. "Each period of our national history has had its special challenges. Those that confront us now are as momentous as any in the past. Today marks the beginning not only of a new administration, but of a period that will be eventful, perhaps decisive, for us and for the world." He looked solemn and determined as he read from a loose-leaf notebook. The voice was surprisingly strong. There was no hesitation, no stumbling over words. It was plain that he had worked on all of it, knew every line. Those close by on the platform could see his breath frosting the air. The speech was devoted exclusively to foreign policy. Though a major statement of American aspirations, its focus was the world. The peace of the world. World recovery. People all over the world. He denounced communism as a false doctrine dependent on deceit and violence. The line between communism and democracy was clear. "Communism is based on the belief that man is so weak and inadequate that he is unable to govern himself and therefore requires the rule of strong masters. Democracy is based on the conviction that man has the moral and intellectual capacity as well as the inalienable right to govern himself with reason and fairness. Communism subjects the individual to arrest without lawful cause, punishment without trial, and forced labor as the chattel of the state. It decrees what information he shall receive, what art he shall produce, what leaders he shall follow, and what thoughts he shall think. Democracy maintains that government is established for the benefit of the individual. and is charged with the responsibility of protecting the rights of the individual and his freedom in the exercise of those abilities. The future of mankind was at stake, and without naming the Soviet Union, he stressed that the actions resulting from the communist philosophy are a threat to the efforts of free nations to bring about world recovery and lasting peace. Democracy was the vitalizing force in the world. The American people stood firm in the faith that had inspired the nation from the beginning. Americans were united in the belief that all men have a right to equal justice under law and equal opportunity to share in the common good. He was affirmative in spirit, and characteristically, he had specific proposals to make. 4 points, as he said. The United States would continue to support the United Nations. It would keep full weight behind the Marshall Plan. And the United States would join in a new defense arrangement among the freedom-loving nations of the North Atlantic to make it sufficiently clear that any armed attack affecting our national security would be met with overwhelming force. But it was the final proposal, his fourth point, that caught everyone by surprise. He called for a bold new program for making the benefits of American science and industrial progress available to underdeveloped countries. It was the first mention of what would become known as the Point 4 program. The old imperialism, exploitation for foreign profit, had no place in the plan, Truman said. Half the people in the world were living in conditions close to misery. And for the first time in history, the knowledge and skill were available to relieve such suffering. The emphasis would be on the distribution of knowledge rather than money. The material resources which we can afford to use for assistance of other peoples are limited, but our imponderable resources in technical knowledge are constantly growing and are inexhaustible. Democracy alone can supply the vitalizing force to stir the peoples of the world into triumphant action, not only against their human oppressors, but also against their ancient enemies, hunger, misery, and despair. The applause was immense and sustained. He was extending the promise of America beyond America. Poverty, he had said in his State of the Union address, was just as wasteful and just as unnecessary as preventable disease. Now he had extended that idea. "Truman proposes fair deal plan for the world," said the headline in the Washington Post. Moreover, he had been eloquent and moving, as he had seldom ever been. Many thought it the finest speech he had ever made. Franklin Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Theodore Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln would all have approved and joined in the applause, said the New York Times. Before the parade, in the interlude during which the president was to be received at lunch in the Capitol, a giant air armada like none ever seen over Washington roared across the sky. Some 700 planes, including transports like those supplying Berlin, and 5 gigantic new 6-engined B-36 bombers that had flown nonstop 2,000 miles from Texas. As the last of the planes passed, the grim president of the inaugural platform, the man with the weight of the world on him, became Radiant Harry Truman once more. As he and Barclay, bundled again in overcoats and grinning broadly under their high silk hats, pulled away in the open Lincoln and started slowly back down Pennsylvania Avenue. To either side now marched the Battery D Honor Guard, 2 lines of somewhat portly, gray-haired middle Americans swinging white ash walking canes, keeping pace with the big car rather smartly and all more or less in step as the delighted crowd cheered them on. Only two would drop out in the mile-and-a-quarter route to the White House. The whole pageant struck countless viewers, including many who had witnessed numerous inaugurations, as profoundly stirring. It was a day of dedication for the democratic spirit, with all elements, large and small, momentarily in harmony. The clear sunlight, the president's evident high spirits, said the New York Times, the patience and cheerfulness of the great crowds, such moving episodes as the presence of a guard of honor of Mr. Truman's comrades of the First World War, the slowly moving masses of men and vehicles coming down the avenue from the seat of the national legislative power to the seat of its executive power, the booming of the presidential salute, the planes overhead, the whole mood of the occasion, all these things seem to speak of a confident and even exultant Americanism. It was democracy looking homeward, across a great continent, but also looking outward toward the world in which democracy will never again be impotent or ashamed or apologetic. Behind the president, the procession stretched 7 miles and would take in all 3 hours to pass. Truman, on reaching the White House, watched the show from a glass-enclosed reviewing stand, and he missed none of it. West Point cadets, midshipmen from Annapolis, the Marine Band, the United States Army Band, all came swinging by. Companies of Wax, Waves, the Richmond Blues wearing white-plumed helmets, high school bands, police bands, drum majorettes, beauty queens, trick riders, state governors in open cars, a mounted posse of Kansas City cowboys. 15,153 men, women, and children in costume, uniform, and civilian dress, more than 40 bands, 55 floats, trucks, jeeps, armored cars, more than 100 horses, 4 mules from Lamar, Missouri, and an old-time circus calliope tooting, "I'm Just Wild About Harry." With Barkley beside him, Truman clapped his gloved hands, waved, chatted, laughed out loud, beat time to the Marine hymn, swayed his head to the strains of Dixie, bounced up and down on the balls of his feet to keep warm while sipping from a white paper cup of what was reportedly coffee but assuredly was not. "Like the honest Missouri extrovert that he is," wrote Roger Butterfield for Life, "he did not try to hide his moods. The crowds and the cameras saw them all." Governor Adlai Stevenson passed by in advance of the Illinois float. General Eisenhower, in a spontaneous tribute that the crowd adored, stood in the back of his open car and saluted the president. Truman beamed and waved his top hat. When a Plymouth Rock float passed by, its cast of pilgrims suddenly broke out cameras and began snapping pictures of him. Every state, every size, shape, and color of American democracy passed in review in the chilly afternoon sunshine. The last inaugural parade, 8 years before, in 1941, when the country was arming for war, had been a grim procession of military might. The mood now was different. The crowd in the grandstand opposite the president, people in bright scarfs and winter coats, some wrapped in blankets, was a happy crowd, just as it was now a larger, more plentiful America by far. Harry Truman was president of a nation of 147 million people, an increase in population of more than 15 million since the census of 1940. No president in history had ever taken office at a time of such prosperity and power. Industrial production outstripped any previous time in the nation's past, and all other nations of the world. The bumper harvest of the previous fall had been the biggest on record. "There never was a country more fabulous than America. the British historian Robert Payne would write in 1949 after an extensive tour of the country. She bestrides the world like a colossus. No other power at any time in the world's history has possessed so varied or so great an influence on other nations. It is already an axiom that the decisions of the American government affect the lives and livelihood of the remotest people. Half the wealth of the world, more than half the productivity, nearly two-thirds of the world's machines are concentrated in American hands. "The parade was the most fun I have ever had at a parade," wrote David Lilienthal. But the president, as the papers said, was the fellow who was having the best time of anyone. Only twice did he seem to register disapproval. When the Dixiecrat candidate, Governor Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, rode by waving happily, Truman gave him a cold stare. Then, as Governor Herman Talmadge of Georgia, another champion of white supremacy, approached, Truman turned his back. But the only real snub was of Thurmond. Truman had turned as Talmadge passed because an electric heater beneath his feet had short-circuited, sending up smoke, and he was trying to put out the fire. As the sun fell behind the old State Department building and the afternoon grew colder, a Texas delegation appeared, led by a car with a banner on its side, Lieutenant Governor Shivers. The crowd and the president roared. Truman stayed to the end. And at the inaugural ball that night at the Armory, he was still going strong at nearly 2 in the morning. No dancer, he watched and waved from a balcony to a crowd of some 5,000 people. He was dressed in white tie and tails, while Bess, smiling and vivacious, wore a shimmering full-length gown of silver lamé. With them were Mary Jane Truman, J. Vivian Truman and his daughter Martha Ann, Frank and Natalie Wallace, George and May Wallace, Nellie and Ethel Noland. "Everybody looked wonderful," wrote Margaret, who wore pink tulle and spent most of the night on the dance floor. Happiest of all was her father, whose face was shining like a new moon. Section 2. In contrast to his first years in office, and so much to follow, the first 6 months of the new term were a breather for Truman. Until midsummer 1949, things went well on the whole. The outlook remained hopeful. No calamitous domestic issues erupted. There were no sudden international crises to contend with. Greece and Turkey did not fall to communist takeovers, nor would they, nor would France or Italy. Best of all was a decided easing of tension over Berlin that began just days after the inauguration. Realizing that the airlift was an established success and that, in fact, the blockade had backfired on them, the Russians signaled a change in attitude. Stalin was backing down. For the first time since Potsdam, the tide seemed to be turning. Secret negotiations followed. It can almost be stated as a principle that when the Soviets are serious about something, they do it in secret, Chip Bolin observed. And on May 12, 1949, the blockade ended. The lights of Berlin came on again. The airlift was over. After a year and 2 months, 277,804 flights and the delivery of 2,325,809 tons of food and supplies. For Truman, it was a momentous victory. Firmness and patience had prevailed without resorting to force. War had been averted. On May 12th also, the Allied powers approved establishment of a new German Federated Republic, whereby the West Germans were to rule themselves with their own government at Bonn. Things overall looked 50% better than a year ago, Truman confided to Lilienthal. Not even the advance of communist forces in China seemed to discourage him. At Potsdam, Stalin had told him the people of North China would never be communists, and Truman thought that was about right. The dragon was going to turn over, he said, and after that perhaps some advances can be made of it. With what Lilienthal described as a big grin and a large dose of his particular brand of charm, which is not inconsiderable, Truman talked enthusiastically of what a program like TVA could mean for a country like China, to put it on its feet. By then, too, the North Atlantic Treaty had been signed in Washington on April 4th, after much hard, skillful negotiation by Secretary of State Acheson. The United States, Canada, and 10 Western European countries joined in a defense pact whereby an attack on any one would be taken as an attack on all. For the United States, it marked a radical departure with tradition, the first peacetime military alliance since the signing of the Constitution. But had such an agreement existed in 1914 and 1939, Truman was convinced, the world would have been spared two terrible wars. He ranked NATO with the Marshall Plan as one of the proudest achievements of his presidency, and was certain that time would prove him right. And though Acheson and British Foreign Secretary Bevin had done most of the work, it was Truman who provided the commitment, unreservedly, just as he had with the Marshall Plan. His first major act after the election in November had been to instruct the State Department to open negotiations for the new alliance, and he rightly considered it his treaty. "We have really passed a milestone in history," he said in his toast at the state dinner at the Carlton Hotel following the signing ceremony. Objections in the Senate, among conservative Republicans, might be fierce, but he had no doubt the treaty would be approved. As it turned out, opposition in the Senate and the press was unexpectedly mild, approval broad. On July 21st, the Senate voted ratification by a vote of 82-13. The establishment of NATO, the success of the Berlin airlift, the prospect of a prosperous, self-governing West Germany as part of the Western Alliance, all made for a greatly improved atmosphere for Truman. He looks more relaxed. Those drawn lines from his eyes across his cheekbones seem to be considerably modified, Lilienthal noted. In March, he had taken off again for Key West for another working vacation, his sixth at Key West since becoming president. The place appealed to him as nowhere else. He loved the warm sea bathing and balmy tropical nights, as perhaps only an inland North American can. His quarters were in what had been the commandant's residence at the Key West Naval Base, a modest-sized white frame house in the West Indian style with jalousied porches, simply but comfortably furnished. Hibiscus and bougainvillea bloomed in the garden. The cares, the pressures, the formality of the presidency all began to subside almost from the moment he arrived. He put on bright patterned sports shirts, Harry Truman shirts as they became known, and set off on his early morning walks through the picturesque old town of Key West, stopping sometimes for a cup of coffee at a local lunch counter. The White House pouch arrived daily. Members of the cabinet, congressional leaders, the joint chiefs flew in and out for meetings, and some days he was on the phone far more than he liked. But he enjoyed a daily swim, or rather churning the turquoise water in his self-styled side stroke, head up to keep his glasses dry, while one or two Navy boats stood guard to keep other boats at a distance and to watch for barracudas. He loafed in the sun with members of the staff, joked, swapped stories, read, listened to classical music on the phonograph, took an afternoon nap, played poker on the porch nearly every evening, slept soundly, and started off each new day before his walk with a shot of bourbon. His privacy on the base was complete. Nor was security ever a problem, which pleased the Secret Service. The staff all enjoyed themselves, as did the 30-odd reporters who usually made the trip and who had little else to do but enjoy themselves. And with everyone so obviously pleased with his choice of vacation spot, so pleased to be included, pleased to be with him, Truman enjoyed himself that much more. "He was great down in Key West," remembered Jim Rowley, by then head of the Secret Service detail. Soon they were all sporting Harry Truman shirts. To Truman's great delight, even Sam Rayburn, during a visit in November, had put on one printed with flocks of cranes and swaying palm trees. Back in Washington on May 8th, at a party celebrating his 65th birthday in the ballroom of the palatial Lars Anderson House on Embassy Row, as toasts were raised, Truman looked better by far than he had since 1945. Like a man who had few qualms about the future, according to one account. "The president," said his physician, Wallace Graham, "is as close to being an iron man as anyone I know at his age." The one distinct shadow on these first sunny months of 1949 was the tragic fate of Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, who, as far back as the previous summer, had begun looking weary and troubled, and who, since the election, had been acting quite strangely. An intense, introverted, extremely dedicated man by nature, Forrestal had worked himself to a state of near collapse, yet wished only to hold on and work harder. Truman had begun losing confidence in Forrestal even before the fall campaign. Struggling to bring about the reorganization of the military services, an unprecedented killing task, Forrestal had become increasingly indecisive and absorbed in details. "He won't take hold," Truman complained. At one point, exasperated with Forrestal's handling of a problem, Truman had sent an uncharacteristically curt note saying, "This is your responsibility." Then, with the campaign underway, there had been suspicions about Forrestal's loyalty. Whether his meetings with Thomas E. Dewey really concerned defense matters, as Forrestal said, or were arranged in the hope of staying on in the Dewey administration. Drew Pearson called it an open secret that Forrestal wanted to hold on to his job regardless of the outcome in November. And several of those closest to Truman grew convinced that, politically, the Secretary of Defense was no longer to be trusted. Forrestal had also been one of the few members of the cabinet since the departure of Henry Wallace to disagree with the president over policy, over Palestine and civilian control of the atomic bomb, most notably, and now he was adamantly opposed to Truman's position on defense spending. To achieve a balanced budget, Truman insisted on a defense ceiling of $15 billion, a sum equal to more than a third of the entire federal budget, but that Forrestal thought dangerously low given the scale of the Soviet menace. Criticism of Forrestal by the press had grown steadily since his unpopular stand on the Palestine issue, with Drew Pearson and Walter Winchell leading the attack in their columns and radio broadcasts. And for Forrestal, who had long courted the press, this was all extremely painful. He was called a tool of Wall Street and the oil companies, an imperialist, an anti-Semite. Pearson and Winchell tried to create doubt about his personal courage, with a trumped-up account of how years before Forrestal had fled out the back door of his New York City home as jewel thieves accosted his wife. On an NBC radio broadcast in January, a guest claimed that the IG Farben works in Frankfurt had not been bombed during the war because Forrestal owned IG Farben stock, a totally false charge that NBC later retracted. The more amplified the attacks became, the more Truman, who hated to dismiss anyone under almost any circumstances, was inclined to keep Forrestal where he was. Truman would not have him leave under fire. In February, Drew Pearson had attacked Harry Vaughan for accepting a decoration from the Argentine dictator Juan Perón, a decoration that several others, including Generals Eisenhower and Bradley, had received earlier, but about which nothing had been said. Pearson had called for Vaughan's immediate dismissal, and Truman publicly responded by calling Pearson an SOB, which raised a new storm of adverse comment and gave Truman a great deal of satisfaction. "No commentator or columnist names any members of my cabinet or my staff," he said. "I name them myself, and when it is time for them to be moved on, I do the moving, nobody else." It was a sentiment that had been felt by other presidents before him, and would be often again by more who followed in his place, but that none stated so openly in so many words. Forrestal, as he told a friend, felt that Truman had always been very fair with him. "Truman was the best boss I have ever known." To another friend, he wrote that the American people were fortunate to have in the highest office a man who, while he reflects the liberal forces both in his country and throughout the world, is nevertheless conservative in the real sense of that word, a conserver of the things we hope to keep. Forrestal was still greatly admired by several of those whose judgment Truman particularly valued. Eisenhower, whom Truman had recently asked to serve as an informal presiding officer of the Joint Chiefs, considered Forrestal one of the best men in public life. And, as Eisenhower recorded privately, more perceptive than Truman concerning the mess we are in due to neglect of our armed forces. "Except for my liking, admiration, and respect for Forrestal's great qualities, I'd not go near Washington, even if I had to resign my commission completely," Eisenhower wrote in his diary in January 1949. "To a certain extent, these same feelings apply to HST, but he does not see the problem so clearly as does Jim, and does not suffer so much due to the failure to solve the problems. I like them both." But Forrestal, as Eisenhower also noted, was looking badly. "He gives his mind no recess, and he works hours that would kill a horse." Eisenhower would himself soon find the bickering between the services all but intolerable. He was smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day and worrying about his blood pressure. By mid-March, he was suffering from severe stomach cramps, and Truman sent him off to recuperate for 3 weeks at the little White House in Key West. A reporter, seeing Forrestal on Inauguration Day, was shocked by his baffled look. Afflicted with insomnia and loss of appetite, Forrestal appeared strangely drawn and aged, his shirt collars too large for him. Some days he would telephone the president several times on the same subject, which left Truman mystified. Privately, Forrestal told a few close friends his phone was being tapped. At meetings, he would unconsciously scratch at a particular part of his scalp until it turned raw. When, in early February, Forrestal told Truman he was resigning and would leave by June 1st, Truman saw it would have to be sooner than that. As Forrestal knew, Truman for some time had been considering Lewis Johnson as his replacement. Johnson, the headstrong financial wonder worker of the Whistle-Stop campaign, who had once served as Roosevelt's Assistant Secretary of War. And Forrestal agreed with the choice, or so he said. Johnson, on meeting Forrestal to discuss the transition, concluded after an hour, as he later told Drew Pearson, that Forrestal was insane, or possibly taking drugs. "Forrestal wanted to resign long before he did," Truman would write, "and I kept him from it, although I realized later that I should have let him quit when he wanted. He left because of failing health, and that's all there was to it." On Tuesday, March 1st, Truman summoned Forrestal to the White House to ask for his resignation. Truman also urged him to take a vacation, though he said nothing about seeking medical attention. Forrestal maintained the necessary composure for public appearances in the following weeks, but only barely. He was present at the Pentagon on March 28th when Lewis Johnson was formally installed as Secretary of Defense, and later in the day he stood mute at another ceremony at the White House when Truman presented him with the Distinguished Service Medal. But the next day, Forrestal, a very sick man, was flown to Florida to Robert Lovett's home at Hobe Sound, where he told Lovett, "They're after me." In the days following, he made at least one attempt at suicide. Unaware of what was happening in Florida, but having now heard reports that Forrestal thought he was being followed by foreign agents, Truman asked the head of the Secret Service, U. E. Bowman, to look into the matter at once. The report, marked secret and dated March 31st, said Forrestal's suspicions were unfounded, that he had become of late exceedingly nervous and emotional, and so distraught by the time of his last day as Secretary of Defense that he had not even known his own servants. As a result of his apparent lack of ability to make a positive decision and carry it out, he was assisted and escorted to the plane to Florida by two friends and former associates. When Mr. Forrestal exhibited a last-minute reluctance to make his departure, one of the friends reportedly said to the other, "We have to do something. We can't keep him around here." Forrestal, the report concluded, was suffering from a slight nervous breakdown, which apparently was as much as Truman had been told up to that point. In Florida, a Navy psychiatrist and the renowned Dr. William C. Menninger had been sent for, and on April 2nd, Forrestal was flown back to Washington to be admitted to the Bethesda Naval Hospital for treatment of nervous exhaustion. Drew Pearson reported that Forrestal was out of his mind, and claimed incorrectly that in Florida, Forrestal had rushed out into the street screaming, "The Russians are coming!" Truman called on Forrestal at Bethesda the first week in May and thought Forrestal seemed his old self. 2 weeks later, on Sunday, May 22nd, at 2 a.m, Forrestal sat in his room on the 16th floor of the hospital, copying lines from Sophocles' Chorus from Ajax. "Worn by the waste of time, comfortless, nameless, hopeless, save in the dark prospect of the yawning grave." About 3 o'clock, he walked across the hall to a small kitchen. After tying one end of the sash from his bathrobe to a radiator and the other end around his neck, he jumped from the unbarred window. His body was found on the roof of the third floor, the sash still around his neck. The news rocked Washington. Suicide among high-ranking government figures was unknown. Other cabinet members had resigned over the years or been fired under a cloud, but none had ever taken his own life. Truman, in his words, was inexpressibly shocked and grieved. The First Lady, haunted by memories of her father, was, as Margaret later revealed, terribly shaken. At Easter, only the week before, Bess had sent Forrestal a bouquet of roses, and in a note of appreciation he had said how much they had helped brighten a bleak day. "I am moved that you should trouble to send me a token, but it's typical of your thoughtfulness. A happy Easter to you and the President and Miss Truman. You all deserve it." The President and Vice President, former President Hoover, the Cabinet, much of Congress, members of the Supreme Court, the Joint Chiefs, General Marshall, an estimated 6,000 people were present for Forrestal's burial with full military honors at Arlington. Truman, angry, troubled, doubtless remorseful that he hadn't acted sooner to relieve Forrestal from duty, accused Drew Pearson of hounding him to death. Pearson wrote that it was Truman's call for Forrestal's resignation that undoubtedly worsened the illness. David Lawrence, in his column in the Washington Star, said it was not work that killed Forrestal, but the president's loss of confidence in him. Questions about the tragedy persisted. Why had Forrestal, in his condition, with suicidal tendencies, been placed in a 16th-floor room? Had his priest been denied the chance to see him? As time went on and fear of communist conspiracy spread in Washington, it would be rumored that pages from Forrestal's diary had been secretly removed on orders from the White House, that Forrestal, the most ardent anti-Soviet voice in the administration, had in fact been driven to his death as part of a communist plot, and the evidence destroyed by secret communists on Truman's staff. But as ever in Washington, it was who was in power that mattered most. And so the focus of attention swiftly shifted to the new Secretary of Defense, who, with his previous experience in the department, his reputation for getting things done, had seemed well equipped for the job. Lewis Johnson was tough, hard-headed, and importantly, committed to the president's policy of holding the line on spending. On the Hill, Democrats and Republicans liked what they saw. The Senate approved the appointment unanimously. But in little time, Johnson's personal style and mode of operation made him a figure of extreme controversy. He hit the Pentagon like a cyclone. Johnson's first move was to evict several high-ranking officers from the largest office in the building and make it his own. He resurrected General Pershing's old desk and installed Roosevelt's press secretary, Steve Early, as a deputy. Half of all Pentagon employees, some 25,000 people, were shuffled about in a gigantic game of musical chairs. He did away with outdated service boards, cut back the use of official cars. Johnson was doing what Truman had asked for. From his experience on the Truman Committee, Truman was convinced that huge sums were being wasted in defense spending. He had a basic distrust of generals and admirals when it came to spending money. In late April, with no advance warning to the president or the Secretary of the Navy, Johnson suddenly canceled construction of a new $186 million supercarrier, United States, a major component in the Navy's whole program, with the result that the Secretary of the Navy, John Sullivan, resigned in a rage. Truman, who liked Sullivan and did not blame him for resigning, nonetheless approved the cancellation. Still, Johnson's manner troubled him greatly. In May, to the disbelief of the Joint Chiefs, Johnson ordered another $1.4 billion slashed from the military budget. To those who charged he was weakening the country's defense, Johnson boasted that the United States could lick Russia with one hand tied behind our back. Where Forrestal had been small, introverted, and apolitical almost to a fault, Johnson was a great boisterous bear of a man who shouted to make his point to an admiral or general and exuded such overt political ambition, stirred such speculation as to his true motives, that he felt obliged after only a few months on the job to state publicly several times that he was not running for president. The press quoted an unnamed high official who said Johnson was making two enemies for every dollar he saved. As was becoming rapidly apparent, Lewis Johnson was possibly the worst appointment Truman ever made. In a little more than a year, many who worked with him, including Truman and Dean Acheson, would conclude that Johnson was mentally unbalanced. "Unwittingly," wrote General Bradley later, "Truman had replaced one mental case with another." The president, the country read, was in high good humor, cheerful and chipper, and busy. He named Attorney General Tom Clark to the Supreme Court, made Howard McGrath the new Attorney General, put Bill Boyle, his old Kansas City protege and whistle-stop mastermind, in McGrath's place at the head of the Democratic Party. He also picked Pearl Mesta to be the new minister to Luxembourg, an appointment of no great importance, but remembered fondly because it inspired a hit Broadway musical, Call Me Madam, with music by Irving Berlin and Ethel Merman in the title role. But even before spring vanished in the furnace heat of June and another long summer settled on the city, Truman's good cheer and optimism were being put to the test. The wave of anti-communism that had been gathering force since the charges against Alger Hiss erupted the previous summer now grew more serious, with Cardinal Spellman of New York, among others, saying America was in imminent danger of a communist takeover. In December 1948, Hiss was indicted for perjury. But the real issue, everyone knew, remained the same. Was he or was he not a communist spy? And how many more like him were there in government? The country, Truman assured reporters, was not going to hell. They ought to read some history. America had been through such times before. Hysteria finally died down and things straightened out, and the country didn't go to hell, and it isn't now. When the Hiss trial ended in a hung jury in July, another trial was scheduled for the fall. As Truman failed to foresee, the issue was not going to go away. Then, at midsummer, the outlook became dramatically worse. Indeed, by August 1949, Truman had entered a time of severe trial. Events beyond his control, in China and the Soviet Union, rocked the Western world as nothing had since the war. While on Capitol Hill, as if to provide a kind of perverse comic relief, Harry Vaughan was summoned before a Senate investigating committee. The news from China had been grim all year. Truman's oddly sanguine remarks on the subject to David Lilienthal notwithstanding. The Chinese nationalist regime of Chiang Kai-shek had been crumbling fast before the onrush of the communists. The American military advisor to Chiang, General David Barr, reported that the military situation has deteriorated to the point where only the active participation of United States troops could effect a remedy. No battle has been lost since my arrival due to lack of ammunition or equipment. The nationalist debacles, in my opinion, can all be attributed to the world's worst leadership, the widespread corruption and dishonesty through the nationalist armed forces. In April, a communist army of 1 million men crossed the Yangtze River, south, into the last provinces still loyal to Chiang. The outcome, the complete fall of China to the forces of Mao Zedong, an outcome implicit as early as 1946 in what George Marshall reported after his fruitless year in China, had by spring become a foregone conclusion. Vehement alarm was sounded. Angry, vindictive charges were made against the administration by what had become known as the China Lobby, whose numbers included religious and patriotic groups across the country, prominent Republicans in Congress, and Time and Life publisher Henry R. Luce, who was the son of missionaries to China. Life had carried an article by General MacArthur titled, "The Fall of China Imperils the U.S." Time warned that the red tide rising in Asia threatened to engulf half the peoples of the world. Yet it was the administration's own attempt to account for its China policy, an effort intended to clarify what was about to happen in China before it happened, and thereby calm the country, that gave focus to this momentous turn of history as nothing else had, and with unexpected consequences. At a morning press conference on August 4th, Truman announced the release of a massive State Department report, United States Relations with China, with special reference to the period 1944 through 1949, 409 pages in length, with another 645 pages of appended documents in smaller print. He had asked to have it compiled, Truman said, as a frank and actual record, clear and illuminating, everything you want to know about the policy from the 1840s onward. As Dean Acheson stressed in a preface to the report, the United States had poured more than $2 billion into support for Chiang Kai-shek since VJ Day, money and arms to help destroy communism in China. But it had not been enough. The fault, said Acheson, was in the internal decay of the nationalist regime, its rampant corruption, lack of leadership, its indifference to the aspirations of the Chinese people. The unfortunate but inescapable fact is that the ominous result of the civil war in China was beyond the control of the United States. It was the product of internal Chinese forces, forces which this country tried to influence but could not. Truman, his spelling no better than ever, had said in a handwritten note earlier that a corrupt, C-U-R-R-U-P-T, nationalist government was the cause of China's woes. "We picked a bad horse," he told Arthur Vandenberg. The China White Paper caused a sensation. Affection for China was widespread in the country. Generations of American children had carried nickels and dimes to Sunday school to support missionaries in China. Books by Pearl Buck about Chinese peasant life had won the hearts of millions of readers. Chiang Kai-shek, the Generalissimo, and his smiling, photogenic, Wellesley-educated wife had been America's loyal allies through the war. Now the State Department was declaring officially that China, the largest nation on earth, was lost to communism. Instead of serving as a palliative, as Truman and Acheson intended, the report inflamed the controversy. The New York Times judged it a sorry record of well-meaning mistakes. More outraged critics called it a whitewash, a deliberate distortion, and worse, a smooth alibi for the pro-communists in the State Department who aided in the communist conquest of China. In the Senate, Republican William Noland of California wondered aloud, and without a shred of evidence, whether Alger Hiss had helped shape China policy. The China lobby raised the cry that Truman and Acheson had lost China, as though China had been America's to lose. A few Democrats, too, joined in the attack, including Representative John F. Kennedy of Massachusetts. At the same time, Harry Vaughan was back in the news, in what had all the signs of a full-blown White House scandal. A Senate subcommittee chaired by Democrat Clyde R. Hoey of North Carolina had begun investigating so-called 5%ers, those who, for 5% commissions, used their supposed influence to secure contracts or favored treatment from the government. Vaughan, it was revealed by several witnesses, had used his high position, his general's stars, his White House telephone, and his place in Harry Truman's affections, to ease the way for such men about Washington as James V. Hunt, a former Army officer who claimed to be one of Vaughan's best friends, and mysterious John Marrigan, truly an old friend of Vaughan's, who in the first weeks of Truman's presidency in 1945 had been seen about the West Wing so often he was thought to be one of the staff. When it was shown that Hunt had improper influence with the chief of the Army Chemical Corps and the quartermaster general, Truman immediately ordered the retirement of the first and the suspension of the second officer. Most of Vaughan's activities in behalf of such friends dated from just after the war. As a favor to Hunt, he had helped obtain scarce lumber for construction of a California racetrack, a project being blocked by government restrictions on building materials needed for housing. For Marigan, he secured a permit for the purchasing of molasses, another scarce item. For a Chicago perfume manufacturer, another of Hunt's clients, he arranged a priority flight to Europe by Air Transport Command, at the time when Germany had just surrendered and virtually all transport facilities were preempted for military use, an arrangement whereby the Chicago manufacturer returned home with perfume essence valued at $53,000. There was nothing illegal about the operations of the five percenters, nothing illegal about what Vaughn had done. But, as had also been disclosed, the same Chicago perfume manufacturer, David A. Bennett, had made Vaughn a gift of a cold storage food container, a deep freezer, valued at approximately $400. Moreover, at Vaughn's suggestion, Bennett sent five more freezers. One to the First Lady, which broke down and had to be junked, one to Fred Vinson, who was then Secretary of the Treasury, one to J.K. Vardaman, who installed it in his Rappahannock County, Virginia mountain retreat, another to Matt Connolly, and another to John Snyder, who returned it. Summoned before the Hoey Committee, Vaughn insisted he had only been trying to be helpful. "I do these people a courtesy of putting them in contact with the persons with whom they can tell their story," he explained. It was, of course, what every politician in Washington did almost daily. Nor was there a law against public officials accepting gifts from friends and constituents, as many news accounts were careful to point out. The president himself was constantly receiving and accepting gifts of all kinds— paintings, prize turkeys, country hams, Havana cigars, liquor, even a Ford automobile during his first year in office. "The freezers," said Vaughn, "were an expression of friendship and nothing more." And Chairman Hoey, after Vaughn's 2 days of testimony, acknowledged there was no evidence of corruption on Vaughn's part. Yet the damage was done. The freezers had been kept confidential, and Vaughn's use of his privileged position, if not illegal, had been decidedly inappropriate and inept. His poor judgment, the almost ludicrous lack of propriety that had so long concerned others at the White House, like Charlie Ross and Eben Ayers, had caught up with him. Though his manner before the committee was calm and respectful, even impressive at times, by appearance, Vaughn seemed anything but a figure of rectitude. Grossly overweight, his uniform, for all its brass and ribbons, looking about as military as pajamas, he was like a cartoonist's portrait of corruption. Thomas Nast would have gloried in the chance to draw him, as, slouching back in his witness chair, Vaughn lit up a big cigar. The Republicans on the committee had prepared, as Time wrote, for a political barbecue with Vaughn as the pig on the spit. But the one who enjoyed it most, glowering at the witness, pointedly addressing the uniformed general as Mr. Vaughn, was Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin. "Was it true," asked McCarthy, "that he had taken campaign contributions from racket king Frank Costello?" "Am I supposed to know Frankie Costello? How did he get in here?" responded Vaughn, rightfully incredulous. If the hearings had proven anything, it was only that Vaughn was an embarrassment who, in the guise of a general, played courthouse politics from the White House in a style reminiscent of the Harding days. Five percenters and deep freezers became odious new catchwords, to the extreme pleasure of the Republicans. "Ross and I discussed the whole thing at some length," wrote Eben Ayers. "We agreed that Vaughn is entirely to blame for his troubles and the troubles he has brought on the president and others. but he seems to have no realization of what harm he has caused. What Truman did was just what everyone who knew him well knew he would do. Had he been constituted differently, had he been able to see the commotion over Vaughn as justified and not an attack on him personally, which was how he interpreted it, had he been able to see that Vaughn was a serious liability and been willing to sacrifice him for the sake of the public trust, not to say his own reputation, then things might have gone differently. But he did not, and this, as time would tell, was a mistake. Beneath everything, Truman not only liked Vaughn, but liked how Vaughn conducted himself, and particularly with respect to the press. When, in the midst of the hearings, Vaughn had arrived back in Washington after a vacation and was confronted by reporters at Union Station, he had warned them to go easy on him. "After all, I am the president's military aide, and you guys will all want favors at the White House someday." Asked about his connection with the five percenters, he said, "That's nobody's goddamn business, and you can quote me." A response that so warmed Truman's heart when he read it that he pinned a mock decoration on Vaughn for Operation Union Station. "I think," Alban Barkley would later comment, "that Mr. Truman was far too kind and loyal to certain old friends who took advantage of him and whose actions sometimes were no credit to his administration." When Vaughn offered to resign, Truman told him to say no such thing in his presence ever again. They had come into the White House together, Truman said, and they would go out together. Only weeks later came the most stunning news of all, portending, as David Lilienthal wrote, a whole box of trouble. An Air Force weather reconnaissance plane, flying at 18,000 feet from Japan to Alaska, had detected signs of intense radioactivity over the North Pacific, east of the Kamchatka Peninsula. Soon, planes elsewhere over the Pacific were reporting radioactivity as much as 20 times above normal. The radioactive cloud was tracked by the Air Force from the Pacific nearly to the British Isles, where it was picked up by the RAF. It took several days for scientists to analyze the data. Their conclusion was reached the afternoon of Monday, September 19th. Lilienthal, who was on vacation at Martha's Vineyard, received the news that night in memorable fashion. As he and his wife were returning from a dinner party to their house near the northern shore of the island, they saw the figure of a man suddenly loom up out of the ground fog caught in the glare of their headlights. It was General James McCormick, who looked bemused, thought Lilienthal, as if I frequently found him on a windswept moor in the dead of night on an island. Later, alone with Lilienthal in an upstairs room lit by a single kerosene lamp, McCormick gave Lilienthal his report. "The coal oil lamp between us," Lilienthal wrote, "the shadows all around, outside through the windows, the Great Dipper and the North Star off toward the lights of New Bedford. I took it with no outward evidence of anything more than a budget problem." "Was he disturbed over something?" his wife asked after they had gone to bed. "Oh, some. One of those things," he said. By 8:20 the next morning, he and McCormick were on their way to Washington in an Air Force C-47. Lilienthal was to see Truman at the White House that afternoon. By 11:30, he was at his office conferring with a hurriedly assembled advisory commission of nuclear scientists chaired by J. Robert Oppenheimer, who looked frantic. "There was no question," said Oppenheimer. "The Russians had detonated an atomic bomb." "Vermont affair? We are here," Lilienthal wrote, Vermont being the code name for the Russian bomb. How was the president taking the news? Would he tell the country? And how soon? Lilienthal saw Truman promptly at 3:45. And later in his diary, in almost telegraphic style, he put down this extraordinary account of their half-hour together. The president was reading a copy of the Congressional Record, as quiet and composed a scene as imaginable. Bright sunlight in the garden outside. He said, "Want to talk about this detection report. Knew about it, knew it would probably come. German scientists in Russia did it, probably something like that. Be glad to call in the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy chairman, ranking minority member, tell them. Not going to say anything myself now. Later, when this," Truman pointed to a newspaper with headlines about the devaluation of the British pound, "quiets down, maybe in a week. Realize, may leak, lots of people know. Still, take that chance. Meet it when it comes." I said, "May I have permission to state my views, despite fact you have reached conclusion?" He took off his glasses. First time I saw him without them. Large, fine eyes. Considerate, fine air of patience and interest. I tried to set out affirmative virtue of making the announcement now and initiating matter rather than plugging leaks. First, would show President knows what is going on in Vermont, Russia. Second, President knowing and saying so would show him not scared, hence others needn't be. Third, would show President will tell people when things come along they need to know that won't hurt being told. The President agreed that maintaining confidence of people in him, taking cue from his own calm, was good point, but not afraid of that. Can't be sure, anyway, that the Russians actually had the bomb. I stepped into that. Is sure, substantial, and great surprise even to the most pessimistic. Really? Sharp look. But an announcement by him might cause great fears, troubles. They, the Russians, changed, talking very reasonably again. Things look better since the end of the Berlin crisis. This may have something to do with it. Not worried, took this into account, going to work things out. 3 days later, the morning of Friday, September 23rd, with the White House press crammed into his office, Charlie Ross asked first that the door be closed, then passed out a mimeographed statement from the president. In an instant, reporters were stampeding for the press telephones, smashing the head of a stuffed deer in their rush. "I believe the American people, to the fullest extent consistent with national security, are entitled to be informed of all developments in the field of atomic energy. That is my reason for making public the following information. We have evidence that within recent weeks an atomic explosion occurred in the USSR." As the statement also said, the eventual development of this new force by other nations was to be expected. Nonetheless, the news was 3 to 5 years ahead of most predictions, and the realization came as an immense shock. The 4-year American monopoly on the atomic bomb was over. And though there was no panic in the country, the fears and tensions of the Cold War were greatly amplified. It was a different world now. A week later, on October 1st in Peking, the People's Republic of China, the most numerous communist nation in the world, with more than 500 million people, 1/5 of humanity, was officially inaugurated. Very soon afterward, in October 1949, in a series of highly secret meetings at the offices of the Atomic Energy Commission, discussion began on the subject of a thermonuclear or hydrogen weapon, a superbomb or super, which would have more than 10 times the destructive power of the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Russian bomb, it was felt, had changed the situation drastically. And if the Russians were capable of producing an atomic bomb, then the Russians, too, were in a position now to push forward with the more devastating weapon. The initial proposal for the super had come from Lewis Strauss of the Atomic Energy Commission, with strong support from the physicist Edward Teller. James B. Conant, who had served on the president's interim committee on the first bomb, was flatly opposed. So was Oppenheimer. Enrico Fermi seemed at first to favor going ahead, then changed his mind. In the end, the Scientific Advisory Committee expressed its opposition to the project on both technical and moral grounds. General Bradley was for it mainly for its psychological importance. Clearly, there would have to be a presidential decision. Lilienthal had privately concluded that he, too, was against the super. "We keep saying we have no other course," Lilienthal wrote. "What we should be saying is, we are not bright enough to see any other course." But the morning of Tuesday, November 1st, he met with Dean Acheson to explain the essence of the business, so Acheson might take it up with the president soon before he, Lilienthal, and others presented it in greater detail. "What a depressing world it was," Acheson remarked after listening to Lilienthal. He didn't know how Lilienthal had lived with this grim thing. In the evening of that same first day in November 1949, the president sat down to dinner at Blair House alone. Bess Truman, as she had been for most of the summer, was away in Independence, looking after her mother. Margaret was in New York pursuing her singing career, and as always, their absence left him feeling downcast, if not occupied with work or people around him. Several times over the long, difficult summer in letters home, he had grown more reflective than usual, recounting events that had brought him to where he was. "We can never tell what is in store for us," he had said to Bess. "Never in my wildest dreams did I ever think or wish for such a position," he told Nellie and Ethel Noland. He had succeeded in getting myself into more trouble than Pandora ever let loose in the world. If he felt Bess's absences more than usual, it was because their life together now in Blair House seemed such an improvement over what it had been across the avenue. The house itself, even with the quick cosmetics applied the year before, was not only nothing very grand, but a bit dowdy. It creaked and groaned, trembled noticeably whenever streetcars passed by outside. Its dark old cellar was full of rats, as was well known by the Secret Service men who hated ever having to go down there. And with Washington's Emergency Hospital located just around the corner on F Street, ambulance sirens screamed by in the street below the president's bedroom window, often several times a night. Of all the presidents they had known, some of the Secret Service men would later say, only Harry Truman would have been willing to live in the place. But with Margaret no longer at home, and without the burden of White House entertaining, the president and the First Lady had more time alone together, sitting in the small back garden reading, having lunch, or resting. Indeed, it was the first time in their married life that they had ever had a house to themselves. Very discreet, very polite, they spent a lot of time behind closed doors in Blair House, remembered J.B. West. Maids joked about the lovebirds upstairs, and in recounting his memories of the Truman years, West would later provide the one known suggestion of the sexual attraction between these two very private, essentially Victorian people. Sometime earlier that fall, when Bess had returned from a long stay with her mother in Independence, both she and the president had been so jubilant, so obviously happy to be with each other again, that the whole domestic staff felt a lift of spirits. Everybody kept grinning, West remembered. The next morning, when West reported to the First Lady's study at 9 as usual to go over the day's menu, she told him, in a rather small, uncomfortable voice, that there was a little problem with the President's antique bed. Two of the slats had broken during the night, she said, blushing. He would attend to it immediately, said West, who had concluded, as he later wrote, that the Trumans were definitely not antiques. Now, the evening of November 1st, with Bess back again in Independence, and after another hell of a day, Truman penned one of the most delightful of all his diary sketches of himself. Part melancholy, part amusing, entirely human and in character. Had dinner by myself tonight. Worked in the Lee House office until dinner time. A butler came in very formally and said, Mr. President, dinner is served. I walked into the dining room in the Blair House. Barnett, in tails and white tie, pulls out my chair, pushes me up to the table. John, in tails and white tie, brings me a fruit cup. Barnett takes away the empty cup. John brings me a plate. Barnett brings me a tenderloin. John brings me asparagus. John brings me carrots and beets. I have to eat alone and in silence in a candle-lit room. I ring. Barnett takes the plate and butter plates. John comes in with a napkin and a silver crumb tray. There are no crumbs, but John has to brush them off the table anyway. Barnett brings me a plate with a finger bowl and doily on it. I remove finger bowl and doily, and John puts a glass saucer and a little bowl on the plate. Barnett brings me some chocolate custard. John brings me a demitasse. At home, a little cup of coffee, about two good gulps, and my dinner is over. I take a hand bath in the finger bowl and go back to work. What a life! Section 3. Of the 9 members of his cabinet, none was so conspicuous or had more influence on Truman than the elegant, polished Dean Acheson, Secretary of State. His place was unrivaled. Unlike Woodrow Wilson, whose portrait over the mantel in the cabinet room still kept watch over gatherings of the cabinet each Friday morning at 10, Truman had no inside advisor like Colonel Edward House. Nor was there anyone serving as international troubleshooter the way Harry Hopkins had for Roosevelt. The relationship between Truman and Acheson was clear and unimpeded, as Truman wished. Acheson ran the vast operations of state with its 22,000 employees, but he was also the president's continuous contact with the world, his reporter and interpreter of world events, as well as his chief negotiator and spokesman on foreign policy. Apart from cabinet meetings, where Acheson sat on Truman's immediate right, they saw each other regularly twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays at 12:30, and talked by phone almost daily. Truman considered the importance of the office of Secretary of State second only to his own, and had filled the job 3 times now with men of proven ability and strong personality. Of Edward Stettinius, the secretary he had inherited from Roosevelt and quickly replaced, Truman wrote, "A fine man, good-looking, amiable, cooperative, but never an idea, old or new." No figurehead secretary, no mere dispenser of White House policy would answer. But in Acheson he had found his most exceptional secretary, and one who, unlike either of his 2 predecessors, Burns and Marshall, had assumed the responsibilities of the office after years of experience in the department, and after having already played a decisive part in the 2 landmark achievements of Truman's first term, the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan. There was no one in the administration or in the cabinet or on the White House staff whose views overall whose sense of proportion, timing, sense of history, whose personal code and convictions concerning America's role in the world carried such weight with the president as Acheson, or whose trust and friendship were to mean as much in the long run. "It was a great thing between Mr. Truman and me," Acheson would recall. "Each one understood his role and the other's. We never got tangled up in it. I never thought I was the president, and he never thought he was the secretary. It is important that the relations between the president and his secretary be quite frank, sometimes to the point of being blunt. And you just have to be deferential. He is the president of the United States, and you don't say rude things to him. You say blunt things to him. Sometimes he doesn't like it. That's natural, but he comes back and you argue the thing out. But that's your duty. You don't tell him only what he wants to hear. That would be bad for him and for everyone else." Truman often referred to Acheson as his top brain man in the cabinet. That Harry Truman of Missouri, product of the Pendergast machine, bosom pal of Harry Vaughan, could possibly have anything in common with Dean Goodrum Acheson, Groton, class of 11, Yale, class of 15, Harvard Law, class of 19, or feel at ease in such a partnership, struck many as almost ludicrous. Acheson was still another surprise in the presidency of this continuously surprising president. He seemed to be everything Truman would find objectionable. The ultimate striped pants boy, were one to judge by appearance. And in Acheson's case, it was nearly impossible not to judge by appearance, since that, at first glance, was much the most impressive thing about him. With his beautiful chalk-stripe English flannel suits, his striking carriage, his bristling guardsman's mustache and luxuriant eyebrows, Acheson looked not quite real, more like an actor cast for the part of Secretary of State. A tall, slim, imperious, emphatically English-looking Secretary of State. Everything was in order. Expensive English shoes rubbed to a fine gloss, the correct quantity of cuff showing spotlessly, hair brushed back from a noble brow. He was just over 6 feet tall, but the perfect tailoring and perfect posture, the lift of the head, made him seem taller still. He could not go unnoticed. Among the fond memories of Washington in these years would be the sight of the Secretary of State on his way to work in the morning, leather dispatch case in hand, walking the mile and a half from his home in Georgetown, accompanied by Justice Felix Frankfurter, who, nearly a head shorter, seemed to take two steps for every one of the secretaries. Two celebrated conversationalists, they talked the whole way, and reportedly never about government. While Frankfurter's car followed behind to drive him to the court once he and Acheson parted company at the steps of the State Department. "If Harry Truman were a painter," said a Republican congressman, "and had never laid eyes on Acheson and sat down to paint a picture of a foreign minister, he would come up with a life-size oil of Dean." For years, Senator Lyndon Johnson entertained friends with his imitation of Acheson entering a committee room, nose in the air. Averill Harriman, who had known Acheson since they were undergraduates at Yale, and who worried that Acheson's appearance might prove a handicap, urged him to at least get rid of the mustache, saying, "You owe it to Truman." But the mustache would stay. And if anything about Acheson's appearance or manner or background ever bothered Truman, he did not say so. To Truman, the State Department was a peculiar organization, made up principally of extremely bright people who made tremendous college marks but who have had very little association with actual people down to the ground. They were clannish and snooty, he thought, and he often felt like firing the whole bunch. Yet no such feelings applied to the secretary. Acheson was doing a whale of a job. Truman hoped he would never leave the government. Acheson, who was 56 years old in 1949, had been raised in the small-town America of other times, in Middletown, Connecticut, at the turn of the century, a setting not unlike Independence, Missouri. His mother was the heir to a Canadian whiskey fortune. His father, English by birth and a veteran of the Queen's Own Rifles, was an Episcopal minister, and later Bishop of Connecticut, whose frequent admonition to his son was, "Brace up." Like Truman, Acheson had had his first youthful brush with the real world working with a railroad crew. Like Truman, he relished history and biography. He, too, adored Mark Twain. If Acheson was a fashion plate, so, of course, was Truman in his way. They had their morning walks in common. Both were men of exceptional physical vitality. Both were amateur architects. Truman spoke often of the influence Justice Brandeis had on him in his first years in Washington. Acheson had first come to the city after law school in 1919 to clerk for Brandeis, from whom he often said he learned more than from anyone. Politically, like Truman, Acheson considered himself a little left of center. His stiff appearance to the contrary, Acheson was also a warm-hearted man, with a wit of a kind that greatly appealed to Truman. Acheson enjoyed a convivial drink, a good story. With his father a minister and his mother a distiller's daughter, he liked to say, he knew both good and evil at an early age. And, like Truman, he was devoted to his family. When his oldest daughter, Mary, was stricken with tuberculosis in 1944 and had to be sent to a sanatorium at Saranac, New York, for an extended cure, Acheson wrote to her every night, often revealing how much more of life he savored than was commonly understood. At lunch at the Capitol, I was asked to sit at a table with Jesse Sumner of Illinois, the worst of the rabble-rousing isolationists. We got along famously. She is a grand old girl, and reminded me of the madam in John Steinbeck's Cannery Row, sort of low, humorous, and human. We became great friends and are going to lunch again. I often wonder whether I have any principles at all. It's a confusing world. Writing once to Ethel Noland, Truman had said, "You know, all of us have a very deep sentimental streak in us, but most of the time we are too timid or too contrary to show it." Acheson, when asked years later by Eric Severide how so much trust and affection could have developed between two such seemingly different men as he and the president, said the answer was complicated, but that much of it had to do with what he called Truman's deeply loving and tender nature, adding, "This isn't the general impression of him at all." When Acheson's daughter had to undergo a serious operation while Acheson was out of the country, and it was not certain she would pull through, Truman personally called the hospital every day for a report, which he himself then transmitted to Acheson by overseas phone. "Well, this is the kind of person that one can adore," Acheson later said. "You can have an affection for that man that nothing can touch." Truman, Acheson knew, was far more sentimental than generally known, or than he wished people to know, far more touched by gestures that to many might seem routine. On board his plane later in the year, bound again for Key West, he would write Acheson a brief longhand note marked and underscored personal. "It was good of you to see us off. You always do the right thing. I'm still a farm boy, and when the Secretary of State of the greatest republic comes to the airport to see me off on a vacation, I can't help but swell up a little." "And then he was so fair," Atchison would say. "He didn't make different decisions with different people. He called everyone together. You were all heard, and you all got the answer together. He was a square dealer all the way through." Moreover, Truman welcomed other people's ideas. He was not afraid of the competition of other ideas. Free of the greatest vice in a leader, his ego never came between him and his job. Felix Frankfurter, enlisting the elements of Atchison's personal code, would put loyalty first, followed by truthfulness, and not pretending to be better than you are. Truman had not forgotten that it was Atchison alone who was at Union Station to greet him after the humiliation of the off-year elections in 1946. Atchison, Truman told David Lilienthal, was a fine man. Loyal, sensible, and not like some men who are brilliant. That Atchison had an exceptional capacity for hard work, that he also subscribed to the philosophy that civilization depended largely on a relatively small number of people who were willing to shoulder the hard work necessary, contributed greatly to Truman's regard for him. Atchison believed in clear, orderly thinking. He knew there were no easy answers, no quick remedies. With the world as it was, he said, Americans would have to get over the idea that the problems facing the country could be solved with a little ingenuity or without inconvenience. He did not see the Cold War as an inevitable clash between good and evil. To say that good and evil could not exist in the world was absurd, he told an audience of military officers at the National War College in December 1949. "Today you hear much talk of absolutes. People say that two systems as different as ours and that of the Russians cannot exist in the same world, that one is good and one is evil, and good and evil cannot exist in the world. Good and evil have existed in this world since Adam and Eve went out of the Garden of Eden. The proper search is for limited ends which soon enough educate us in the complexities of the tasks which face us. That is what all of us must learn to do in the United States, to limit objectives, to get ourselves away from the search for the absolute, to find out what is within our powers. We must respect our opponents. We must understand that for a long, long period of time they will continue to believe as they do, and that for a long, long period of time we will both inhabit this spinning ball in the great void of the universe." As would become apparent to everyone soon enough, Atchison was not only the most important member of Truman's cabinet, but the most important appointment Truman ever made. And, unlike Burns and Marshall, he would serve as secretary throughout a full term. Despite vilifications such as few in American public life had ever known. He would be seen as an immense political liability, called a fool and a traitor. Nor were his critics and adversaries to be found only among the ranks of the Republicans. One especially determined to challenge his authority at every chance, to see Atchison taken down several pegs if not entirely, was Lewis Johnson, who clearly disliked him, and whose cutting remarks soon reached the White House. Greatly displeased, Truman warned Johnson to stop it. "Atchison is a gentleman," Truman told James Webb, the former director of the budget, who was now Atchison's undersecretary. "He won't descend to a row. Johnson is a rough customer, gets his way by rowing. When he takes out after you, give it right back to him." Others who knew Atchison thought that in a showdown Johnson wouldn't have a chance. Oliver Franks, the British ambassador and a close friend, described Atchison as a romantic, and a blade of steel. He had a serious, a very serious problem to decide before long, Truman told Lilienthal on November 7th, Acheson having by then talked to him about the super bomb. He hoped to have a full report from the Atomic Energy Commission, AEC, committee soon, Lilienthal replied. Yes, said Truman, he wanted the facts, of course. The report, with its unanimous conclusion by the advisory committee that the superbomb should not be developed, plus a concurring recommendation by the AEC, was delivered 2 days later on November 9th. The AEC had decided against the bomb by 3-2, with Lilienthal the deciding vote. The following day, Truman named Acheson, Johnson, and Lilienthal to act as a special committee of the National Security Council, the Z Committee as it was called, to advise him whether to proceed with the super and whether publicity should be given the matter. A week later, all Washington knew a super bomb was under consideration. A Washington Post reporter, Alfred Friendly, had picked up the first hint of the story from remarks made on a local television broadcast in New York by Democratic Senator Edwin Johnson of Colorado, a member of the Joint Congressional Committee on Atomic Energy, who made his disclosure while airing his fears about the ability of scientists to keep secrets. So suddenly the H-bomb, a new word, was a public issue. Physicists Edward Teller and Ernest Lawrence were lobbying hard for proceeding with it. Carl T. Compton, who served on the interim committee in 1945 and had only just retired as head of MIT, wrote to Truman saying that in the absence of an international agreement on the control of atomic energy, the United States had no choice but to go ahead with the super. At the State Department, stirred by moral outrage, George Kennan labored intensively on a close analysis of the problem, and in a long memorandum to Acheson, a plea as earnest and eloquent as he knew how to make it, he not only declared against the project, but urged that the United States set an example. The last hope for humanity was international control of all weapons of indiscriminate mass destruction. The United States should announce it was prepared to go very far, to show considerable confidence in others, and to accept certain risk for ourselves in order to achieve international agreement. To go forward with this still more fearsome next step would be to commit the country and the world to an indefinite escalation of destructiveness and cost. So the voices against the super were essentially three: Lilienthal, Kennan, and Oppenheimer, who, apart from his own moral objections, did not think such a bomb was technically feasible. But Kennan, like Lilienthal, was about to retire. And the new head of the policy planning staff at the State Department, Paul Nitze, agreed with the Joint Chiefs. To Nitze, Soviet possession of the atomic bomb meant not only that the United States must proceed to work on the H-bomb, but build up its conventional forces as well. Acheson, who, after Hiroshima, favored an atomic partnership with the Soviet Union, had by now come full circle. In effect, he told Kennan to take his Quaker ideas and go. I told Kennan if that was his view, he ought to resign from the Foreign Service and go out and preach his Quaker gospel, but not push it within the department. He had no right being in the service if he was not willing to face the questions as an issue to be decided in the interests of the American people under a sense of responsibility. How can you persuade a paranoid adversary to disarm by example? Atchison asked rhetorically in conversation with another associate. The top-secret debate went on for 3 months, from November 1949 to the end of January 1950, and much of it in Atchison's immense fifth-floor office at the State Department, a room that reminded him, he said, of the cabin-class dining salon on one of the old North German Lloyd ocean liners. But the three-man Z committee of Atchison, Johnson, and Lilienthal met only twice, due primarily, as Atchison said, to the acerbity of Lewis Johnson's nature. Johnson and Lilienthal argued bitterly. The first of these sessions was on December 22nd, the second and last on January 31st. Between times, Truman kept to a full presidential schedule. He appointed Oscar Chapman as Secretary of Interior after the resignation of Julius Krug. He received the new Shah of Iran on a first state visit, posed for photographs with five crippled children for the March of Dimes campaign, issued an executive order authorizing the Federal Housing Administration loans of $20 million for low-rent housing in 27 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico, issued an executive order to the FHA to deny financial assistance to new housing projects with racial or religious restrictions, exchanged Christmas greetings with the Pope, and learned from the Secret Service that in 1949 alone there had been a total of 1,925 threats, written or oral, against him or his family. "The day will come," said one, "when I will have your heart out and give it to the ants as food." 4 days into the new year, in a recently redecorated House chamber, he delivered his fifth State of the Union message. If American productive power continued to increase at the same rate as it had in the previous half century, he told the Congress, then national production 50 years hence would be 4 times as great, the average family income 3 times what it was in 1950, or $12,450 a year, which struck many as unimaginable. Today, by the grace of God, we stand in a free and prosperous nation with greater possibilities for the future than any people have ever had before in the history of the world. At a press conference on January 7, 1950, he presented his annual budget, a big green book the size and weight of a New York telephone directory, and answered questions about it. The total figure was $42.4 billion, which included an increase of $1 billion for domestic programs. But most, some $30 billion, was to pay for wars past and for the present national defense, listed to cost $13.5 billion. It was a budget that did not balance. The estimated deficit was $5 billion, which would mean a national debt by 1952 of $268.3 billion. In a message to Congress, he asked for a moderate tax increase to bring in an additional $1 billion. For an hour at the Shoreham Hotel one night, he stood at the door of a private dining room, shaking hands with virtually every Democrat in Congress. He addressed the AFL dinner and a civil rights conference. He held 5 more press conferences. He also faced the fact that Clark Clifford and David Lilienthal, 2 of his best, were leaving in February to return to private life. The loss of Clifford would be a real blow. But Clifford was worn out and deeply in debt, his living expenses over the past 4 years having run far ahead of his White House salary. He would stay on in Washington to practice law. Lilienthal, too, was exhausted and knew the time had come to move on. Truman, as he said, felt as though the bottom had fallen out. More serious and worrisome, however, was the assault on Dean Acheson. In December, angry over the loss of China and the supposed infiltration of communists everywhere, the Republicans in both houses of Congress called on Truman to fire Acheson. Then, in New York, on January 21st, at the end of a long second trial, Alger Hiss was found guilty of perjury. He had lied about passing secret documents. And that night, Republican Congressman Richard Nixon, who, as the only lawyer on the House Un-American Activities Committee, had played a leading part in the case against Hiss, went on the radio to accuse the administration of a deliberate effort to conceal the Hiss conspiracy. On Wednesday, January 25th, the day Hiss was sentenced to 5 years in prison, Acheson was asked at a press conference at the State Department if he had any comments. The question was not unexpected. At his confirmation hearings the year before, Acheson had acknowledged that Hiss was a friend and remained a friend, adding that his own friendship was not easily given nor easily withdrawn. Hiss's brother, Donald, a partner in Acheson's law firm, had served as Acheson's assistant when Acheson was Assistant Secretary of State. Now, to the throng of reporters, he said, "I should like to make it clear to you that whatever the outcome of any appeal which Mr. Hiss or his lawyers may take in this case, I do not intend to turn my back on Alger Hiss." It was no impulsive response. Acheson had thought long about what to say, and as many in the room sensed at once, it was a decisive moment in the history of the Truman administration. He continued, his voice full of emotion. "I think anyone who has known Alger Hiss or has served with him at any time has upon his conscience the very serious task of deciding what his attitude is and what his conduct should be. That must be done by each person in the light of his own standards and his own principles. For me, there is little doubt about those standards and principles. I think they were stated for us a very long time ago on the Mount of Olives, and if you are interested in seeing them, you will find them in the 25th chapter of the Gospel according to St. Matthew, beginning with verse 34. An aide stood at the door with a Bible ready for those reporters who wished to check the reference. "I was a prisoner, and ye came unto me." Perhaps the voice of the late Bishop of Connecticut, Acheson's father, sounded in the citation, wrote the New York Herald Tribune, one of the few papers to praise Acheson for what he had said. "This newspaper has felt it necessary at times to criticize and oppose Mr. Acheson in his policies, but of this statement made on Wednesday in a difficult hour, we are glad to declare in our judgment it was as courageous as it was Christian." It was also a political disaster. The news reached Capitol Hill almost instantly. Senator Joseph McCarthy interrupted the flow of business in the Senate to report the most fantastic statement just made by the Secretary of State. "Did this mean," McCarthy asked, "that the Secretary would not turn his back on any other communists in the State Department?" His press conference ended. Acheson went immediately to see Truman, who by then had seen the news ticker story. Acheson offered to resign. Truman, Acheson wrote to his daughter, was wonderful about it. Said that one who had gone to the funeral of a friendless old man just out of the penitentiary, Tom Pendergast, had no trouble knowing what I meant and proving it. "So there we are," Atchison added. And as the Persian king had carved on his ring, this too will pass. But pass it did not. The damage done to himself and the president was worse than either knew. Richard Nixon called Atchison's statement disgusting. Republican Senator Hugh Butler of Nebraska exploded in a tirade. I look at that fellow. I watch his smart-aleck manner and his British clothes and that New Dealism and everything he says and does, and I want to shout, get out! Get out! You stand for everything that has been wrong in the United States for years. The atmosphere in Washington, the atmosphere in which the decision on the hydrogen bomb was being weighed, had become charged with rancor and fear. At his press conference the next afternoon, Friday, January 27th, Truman was asked first whether he too would refuse to turn his back on Alger Hiss, to which he replied, no comment. Then, what his views were on the H-bomb, as though the two issues were directly connected. He would have nothing to say until he made a decision, Truman answered, thus acknowledging for the first time that the issue existed. Comment and speculation on the bomb continued. Headlines called it the ultimate bomb, the hell bomb. Life ran an aerial photograph of Chicago showing how much of the city would be obliterated, 50 square miles, by one such weapon. In the Washington Post, where for years he had been drawing the atomic bomb as a sinister presence looming over peace conferences or taking the measure of the world, cartoonist Herb Bloch now portrayed the atomic bomb holding the giant hand of an infinitely larger, more menacing creature labeled Superbomb, and asking a terrified Uncle Sam, "Want to meet my friend, too?" Eleanor Roosevelt and Bernard Baruch announced their support for building the bomb. Harold Urey of the University of Chicago, a leader in atomic research who in 1934 had won a Nobel Prize for his discovery of heavy hydrogen, declared in a speech in New York that the United States could not intentionally lose the armaments race without risking its liberties. Rumors of bitter animosity within the administration, talk of who was for and who was against the H-bomb, became a Washington obsession. On Capitol Hill, Democratic Senator Brian McMahon of Connecticut, chairman of the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, was reportedly almost in tears over the prospect of the bomb not proceeding. War with the Russians was inevitable, the powerful senator assured Lilienthal. The thing to do was blow them off the face of the earth, quick, before they do the same to us. We haven't much time. To Truman, he wrote, if we let Russia get the super first, catastrophe becomes all but certain. Whereas if we get it first, there exists a chance of saving ourselves. The Joint Chiefs wanted a crash program. General Bradley wrote that it was folly to argue whether one weapon is more immoral than another, for in a larger sense it is war itself which is immoral, and the stigma of such immorality must rest upon the nation which initiates hostilities. Despite an understanding that deliberations on the bomb would be kept within the Z Committee, Lewis Johnson quickly sent Bradley's memorandum to Truman. Like a patient sitting in a doctor's anteroom while the specialists discuss his case, wrote Time, the U.S. public sat outside while the president, his military, scientific, and diplomatic advisors debated whether to construct the most powerful explosive weapon the world has yet dreamed of. But since the principle of the hydrogen bomb was also known to the Russians, temporizing was risky and might be fatal. The simple fact, unpleasant though it might be, was that if the Russians are likely to build an H-bomb, the U.S. will have to build it too. When, on Tuesday, January 31, 1950, Acheson, Johnson, and Lilienthal, with several of their aides, convened for the final session of the Z Committee in room 216 of the old State Department building, it was Acheson who took charge. He had concluded that work should proceed on the hydrogen bomb and presented the draft of a statement to be made by the president. Johnson agreed, but Lilienthal did not like rushing things through in an atmosphere of excitement. A decision to go ahead with the bomb now would probably make a new approach to the atomic arms race impossible. He thought the country's almost sole reliance on this kind of weapon was extremely unwise, and that going ahead with it would give the American people a false and dangerous assurance that when we get this new gadget, the balance will be ours as against the Russians. He questioned what the project would do to defense budgets and foreign policy. Acheson, who greatly admired Lilienthal, and who would later describe Lilienthal's objections as eloquently and forcefully expressed, said he could not overcome two stubborn facts: that delaying work on the bomb would not delay Soviet work on their bomb, and that the American people would simply not tolerate a policy of delay. "We must protect the president," Johnson said. And though he still had grave reservations, Lilienthal, too, agreed to sign the statement. Accompanied by Admiral Sidney W. Sowers, the executive secretary of the National Security Council, the three men walked to the White House. Their meeting had lasted 2.5 hours. The meeting with the president took 7 minutes. Truman had already made up his mind, perhaps as much as 10 days earlier. Or, at least, that was the impression of his immediate staff, though he had said nothing specific. Acheson knew this. Apparently they all did. The president, wrote Lilienthal, was clearly set on what he was going to do before we set foot inside the door. As Truman looked over the statement, Acheson said Lilienthal had some additional views to express. Truman, turning to Lilienthal, said he had always believed the United States should never use these weapons, that peace was our whole purpose. Lilienthal said that while he did not overrate the value of his own judgment, he felt he must express his grave reservations about the proposed course. Try as he might, he could not see it as the wisest move. However carefully worded, however issued, the statement would only magnify the essentially mistaken policy of relying on atomic weapons as the country's chief defense. There was too much talk in Congress and everywhere, Truman broke in. People were so excited. He didn't see that he had any alternative. "Can the Russians do it?" he asked the group. It was his only question. They all nodded. "We don't have much time," interjected Admiral Sowers. "In that case," said Truman, "we have no choice. We'll go ahead." As he signed the statement, Truman said he recalled another meeting of the National Security Council concerning Greece, when everybody predicted the end of the world if we went ahead, but we did go ahead and the world didn't come to an end. "It would be the same case here," he said. While the president went home to Blair House for lunch, Charlie Ross again handed out a mimeographed sheet. "It is part of my responsibility as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces to see to it that our country is able to defend itself against any possible aggressor. Accordingly, I have directed the Atomic Energy Commission to continue its work on all forms of atomic weapons, including the so-called hydrogen or superbomb." Lilienthal described the mood at the AEC afterward as that of a funeral party. For him, it was a night of heartache. I hope I was wrong and that somehow I'll be proved wrong, he wrote. We have to leave many things to God. Albert Einstein, in a rare appearance on television, talked of the radioactive poisoning of the atmosphere and warned, "General annihilation beckons." To what extent Truman had struggled with the decision, or dwelled on it afterward, is not known. He left nothing in writing. Nor can Acheson's influence on him be readily gauged, though doubtless it was considerable. Acheson, as Truman said, was one of the most persuasive men he had ever known. It would have been preferable, surely, wiser, more prudent, to have given the entire question longer, closer examination, and under less stress, even assuming Truman would have decided no differently. The country could have been better prepared. There would have been time for a clear, explanatory presidential address to the nation instead of a mimeographed announcement. So disquieting, so momentous, and so costly a step deserved better. In any event, as anticipated, public and editorial approval of the decision was overwhelming. The president had made the right and inevitable decision. Then, in only a matter of days, the level of apprehension was raised still higher by news from London that Klaus Fuchs, a former atomic scientist at Los Alamos, had confessed to being a Russian spy. And by the sudden claim of Senator Joseph McCarthy that he had in his possession a list of more than 200 known communists employed at the State Department. Section 4. With the onrush of so much sensational, seemingly inexplicable bad news, China lost, the Russian bomb, Alger Hiss, the treason of Klaus Fuchs, breaking with such clamor all in less than 6 months, the country was in a state of terrible uncertainty. "How much are we going to have to take?" asked Senator Homer Capehart of Indiana. Life devoted much of one issue to show how vastly Russian military strength exceeded that of the United States. An army of 2,600,000 men, compared to an American force of 640,000. 30 Russian armored divisions to one American. The United States produced 1,200 new planes a year. The Russians, 7,000. Only the American Navy stood first, but the Soviets already had a more powerful fleet than Germany had had at the start of the last war, and three times the number of American submarines. While America spent 6% of its national income on military strength, the Russians were spending 25%, and so on. "War can come, will we be ready?" asked the Life headline. It was, of course, a question of paramount importance within the administration. For months behind the scenes, Acheson had been arguing that Truman's $13 billion limit on defense spending was no longer realistic. Now, with his decision to proceed with the hydrogen bomb, Truman authorized a complete review of military policy. At both the State Department and the Pentagon, work began on a sweeping new report. And with the pressure on, relations between the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense grew steadily more contentious. At a meeting in March, Lewis Johnson exploded with such temper, banging down his chair, shouting objections, hammering his fist on the table, that Acheson could only conclude that Johnson, like Forrestal, had cracked under the strain. When Acheson reported to Truman what had happened, Truman was appalled. Probably it was then he knew that Johnson would have to go, when the time was right. Fear gripped Washington and the country. The air was so charged with fear, remembered Herb Bloch, that it took only a small spark to ignite it. And the spark was McCarthy. When Bloch, in one of his cartoons in the Post, labeled an overflowing barrel of tar McCarthyism, another new word entered the language along with the H-bomb. Until that January, Joseph R. McCarthy, Wisconsin's 41-year-old junior senator, had been casting about for an issue that might lift him from obscurity. All but friendless in the Senate, recently voted the worst member of the Senate in a poll of Washington correspondents, McCarthy appeared to be a hopeless failure. Over dinner one evening at the Colony Restaurant, a Catholic priest, Father Edmund A. Walsh of Georgetown University, suggested he might sound the alarm over communist infiltration of the government. And McCarthy, who had already made some loud, if unnotable, charges about communist subversion, seems to have realized at once that he had found what he needed. A month later, in a Lincoln's Birthday speech in West Virginia, he waved a piece of paper, saying he had, here in my hand, the names of 205 known communists in the State Department. The speech went largely unnoticed, but at Salt Lake City and Reno soon afterward, he made essentially the same claim, except the number was cut to 57, and they were referred to now as card-carrying communists. He made headlines across the country. Back at the Senate, he carried on for 5 hours, claiming to have penetrated Truman's Iron Curtain of Secrecy and come up with 81 names. The charges were wild and unsupported. McCarthy had no names. He produced no new evidence. He was a political brawler, morose, reckless, hard-drinking, a demagogue such as had not been seen in the Senate since the days of Huey Long, only he had none of Long's charm or brilliance. The press called him desperate, a loudmouth, and a character assassin. His communist hunt was a wretched burlesque of the serious and necessary business of loyalty checkups. But he was no more bothered by such criticism than by his own inconsistencies. And whatever he said, the press printed, his most sensational allegations often getting the biggest headlines. To more and more of the country, it seemed that even if he might be wrong in some of his particulars, probably he was on to something, and high time. Harry Truman, McCarthy charged, was the prisoner of a bunch of twisted intellectuals who only told him what they wanted him to know. Attacking Acheson, he said, when this pompous diplomat in striped pants with the phony British accent proclaimed to the American people that Christ on the Mount endorsed communism, high treason, and betrayal of a sacred trust, the blasphemy was so great that it awakened the dormant indignation of the American people. As McCarthy kept up the assault, Acheson received so much threatening mail that guards had to be posted at his house around the clock. While numbers of his fellow Republicans silently deplored McCarthy's methods, others, Bridges, Brewster, Capehart, Munt, Wherry, began lending support. "I will not turn my back on Joe McCarthy," said Brewster. Encouragement came, too, from Senator Taft, who had been the first to introduce the soft-on-communism issue in the 1946 elections, and who now admitted publicly that he was egging McCarthy on to press the attack, to keep talking, and if one case didn't work out, to bring up another. All the anger and resentment felt by Republicans like Taft over Truman's surprise upset in 1948 had found an outlet. Senate Democrats, meanwhile, called for a complete investigation of McCarthy's charges. A special subcommittee of the Foreign Relations Committee began hearings under the chairmanship of Millard Tidings of Maryland, one of the most respected influential Democrats in the Senate. The assumption was that in the bright light of public exposure, McCarthy and his tactics could not long survive. But the attention only magnified him. The hearings in the Senate's marble-columned caucus room gave him center stage and the full attention of the press day after day. "You are not fooling me," he said. "This committee is not seeking to get the names of bad security risks, but to find out the names of my informants so they can be kicked out of the State Department tomorrow." By the end of March, in the 6 weeks since his initial outburst at Wheeling, McCarthy had not named a single communist. He announced he had the name of the top Russian espionage agent in the United States, indeed the one-time boss of Alger Hiss and his espionage ring. The man, said McCarthy, was Owen J. Lattimore, formerly of the State Department and currently director of the Johns Hopkins School of International Relations. As time would show, Lattimore was neither a communist nor ever an influential figure at the State Department. He had worked for the department all of 4 months in 1946 as an advisor on a reparations mission in Japan. The accusation was a fraud. "If you crack this case," McCarthy told the committee, "it will be the biggest espionage case in the history of this country." He was willing, he said, to stand or fall on that. In mid-February 1950, at about the time McCarthy's reckless charges were first making headlines, Truman agreed to an exclusive interview with Arthur Kroc of the New York Times, during which he impressed Kroc as a man of exceptional inner calm and strength. "In an age of atomic energy, transmuted into a weapon which can destroy great cities and the best works of civilization, and in the shadow of a hydrogen detonant which could multiply many times that agent of destruction, a serene President of the United States sits in the White House with undiminished confidence in the triumph of humanity's better nature and the progress of his own efforts to achieve an abiding peace." Harry S. Truman, said Kroc, might seem to many a controversial figure, but to those who had the chance to talk with him intimately, his faith in the future had a luminous quality. "He sits in the center of the troubled and frightened world, but the penumbra of doubt and fear in which the American nation pursues its great and most perilous adventure stops short of him. Visitors find him undaunted and sure that whether in his time or thereafter, a way will be discovered to preserve the world from the destruction which to many seems unavoidable." David Lilienthal, who came to the Oval Office on February 14th for a final farewell meeting with the president, described it later as "one of the happiest sessions I've ever had with him." "About these scientists," Truman said, "we need men with great intellect, need their ideas, but we need to balance them with other kinds of people, too." Lilienthal, perhaps as much as anyone, knew the weight of the burdens Truman carried. Yet Truman looked tip-top, his eye clear. Studying him, listening to him talk, Lilienthal was amazed. As he later wrote, "My admiration and wonder at his relaxed way of looking at things and his obvious good health reached a new high." But his wife of 30 years knew differently, and to her alone he portrayed himself differently. She grew increasingly concerned about his health, the stress the McCarthy attacks put on him. His headaches had returned. In mid-March, Bess urged another retreat to Florida to recover his strength. "You see, everybody shoots at me, if not directly, then at some of the staff closest to me," he wrote to her from Key West. In the Senate, Republican Stiles Bridges had now joined McCarthy and stepped up the attack. Truman had liked Bridges, long considered him a friend. John Snyder had become a target lately. Rumors were Snyder was drinking too much. Caustic comments in the press about Harry Vaughan, the almost constant abuse of Dean Acheson, and belittling comments on his own performance, all that he seemed impervious to, in fact, bothered Truman greatly. And he was feeling not just a little sorry for himself. "The general trend of the pieces," he wrote to Bess, "is that I'm a very small man in a very large place, and when someone I trust joins the critical side, well, it hurts. I'm much older and very tired, and I need support as no man ever did. What has made me so jittery? They started on Snyder and have almost broken him, then Vaughan, whose mental condition is very bad. Now they are after my top brain man in the cabinet. The whole foreign policy is at stake, just as we are on the road to a possible solution. I'm telling you so you may understand how badly I need your help and support now." McCarthy, he felt, was a temporary aberration. A ballyhoo artist who has to cover up his shortcomings by wild charges. Even so, he had had enough. By March 30th, midway through his Key West stay, Truman decided to speak out. By then, according to the polls, half the American people held a favorable opinion of the senator and thought he was helping the country. Truman's own standing, by stark contrast, had plunged to 37%, nearly as low as in the spring of 1948. He called a rare press conference on the lawn beside the little White House, where, with sunny skies overhead and a breeze stirring the palms, talk of the junior senator from Wisconsin seemed strangely incongruous. Looking well-tanned and fit in a light linen suit and open shirt, Truman sat in a white wicker chair with reporters gathered about him in a circle. Did he expect Senator McCarthy to turn up any disloyalty in the State Department? "I think," he said with a hard look, "the greatest asset that the Kremlin has is Senator McCarthy." And there were others, he said, Wherry and Bridges. The Republicans had been searching in vain for an issue for the fall elections. They had tried statism, the welfare state, socialism. Some were even trying to dig up that old malodorous dead horse called isolationism. He was furious. This fiasco going on in the Senate, he said, jabbing a finger in the air, was an attempt to sabotage bipartisan foreign policy. It was a dangerous situation, and it had to be stopped. Dean Acheson, he added emphatically, would go down in history as one of the great secretaries of state. There was no question about that. Was Owen Lattimore a Russian spy? Why, of course not. It's silly on the face of it. It was a dramatic moment, a performance, reporters thought, that equaled Franklin Roosevelt at his angry best. Taft accused Truman of having libeled McCarthy. "Do you think that's possible?" Truman responded when a reporter raised the question at the next press conference back in Washington. To a gathering of the Federal Bar Association, he gave his assurance that no known instance of communist subversion, or subversion of any kind, had gone uninvestigated by the FBI or as a result of his own loyalty program. "There is no area of American life in which the Communist Party is making headway, except maybe in the minds of some people." that his own loyalty program might have contributed to the overall atmosphere that gave rise to McCarthy is a thought he seems not to have entertained, not then at least. I think our friend McCarthy will eventually get all that is coming to him. He has no sense of decency or honor, Truman wrote to Owen Lattimore's sister. You can understand, I imagine, what the president has to stand. Every day in the week, he's under a constant barrage of people who have no respect for the truth and whose objective is to belittle and discredit him. While they are not successful in these attacks, they are never pleasant, so I know just how you feel about the attack on your brother. The best thing to do is to face it, and the truth will come out. Yet nothing Truman or anyone else said seemed to diminish McCarthy or the fear he spread in the government and the nation. When Truman, who had first refused to turn security files over to the Tidings Committee as a matter of principle, decided to let Tidings and the committee come to the White House to look at the files of the 81 people accused by McCarthy, in an effort to help Tidings discredit McCarthy and answer a Republican charge that he, Truman, was covering up evidence, it proved a bad decision. Now, even the president appeared to be caving in to Joe McCarthy. Tidings, in a state of near panic, was on the phone to the White House 3 and 4 times a day. Truman's staff grew extremely worried and on edge. Truman told them to stay calm. McCarthy would destroy himself, he said. The man was a liar. He would be found out and expelled from the Senate. That was how these things worked, and that was how it should be handled. Truman wondered only if there was anyone in the Senate with backbone enough to do the job. When, in the first week of June, the senator with backbone turned out to be a Republican and the Senate's only woman, Margaret Chase Smith of Maine, who declared she did not want to see the Republican Party ride to victory on the four horsemen of calumny, fear, ignorance, bigotry, and smear, Truman told his staff she had done a fine thing, though he thought she should have been tougher still and more specific. It was on a particularly glorious day that spring, on Sunday, April 9, 1950, with lilacs and azaleas blooming in profusion and the cherry blossoms coming full around the tidal basin, that Truman drafted a statement in his own hand that he planned to make public 2 years hence. April 11th marked the end of his fifth year in office, and he had decided not to run for another term. In 1947, as a rebuke to the memory of Franklin Roosevelt and his 4 terms, the Republicans of the 80th Congress had passed the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution, an amendment Truman opposed, limiting presidents to 2 terms. With ratification by the states, it would become law in 1951. But since it had been worded not to include Truman, he was free to run again in 1952, as many, if not most people, assumed he would. He had been thinking about the lure in power and the example set by his hero Cincinnatus, the Roman general who had turned away from power. He was neither discouraged nor angry over the course of events. He remained, in many ways, a man of iron, as Wallace Graham said, and more, a happy man, in the words of one White House reporter, and, as far as the observer could tell, boundlessly sure of himself. But quietly, on his own, without discussion with anyone other than his wife, he had decided he would announce his retirement in the spring of 1952, when he would be 68. "I am not a candidate for nomination by the Democratic Convention. My first election to public office took place in November 1922. I served 2 years in the armed forces in World War I, 10 years in the Senate, 2 months and 20 days as vice president and president of the Senate. I have been in public service well over 30 years, having been President of the United States almost 2 complete terms. Washington, Jefferson, Monroe, Madison, Andrew Jackson, and Woodrow Wilson, as well as Calvin Coolidge, stood by the precedent of 2 terms. Only Grant, Theodore Roosevelt, and FDR made the attempt to break that precedent. FDR succeeded. In my opinion, 8 years as president is enough, and sometimes too much, for any man to serve in this capacity. There is a lure in power. It can get into a man's blood just as gambling and lust for money have been known to do. This is a republic, the greatest in the history of the world. I want the country to continue as a republic. Cincinnatus and Washington pointed the way. When Rome forgot Cincinnatus, its downfall began. When we forget the examples of such men as Washington, Jefferson, and Andrew Jackson, all of whom could have had a continuation in the office, then we will start down the road to dictatorship and ruin. I know I could be elected again and continue to break the old precedent as it was broken by FDR. It should not be done. That precedent should continue, not by constitutional amendment, but by custom based on the honor of the man in office. Therefore, to reestablish that custom, although by a quibble I could say I have only had 1 term, I am not a candidate and will not accept the nomination for another term. The tone, to be sure, was a bit self-congratulatory. And whether his confidence in re-election was altogether sincere, or an added touch for the record, lest anyone see him retiring from the field in fear, is hard to say. The implied charge that Franklin Roosevelt had been something less than a man of honor by choosing to run more than twice was in keeping with his own position on the issue in 1940, but not in 1944, when he was the running mate. Still, it was a statement of conviction like none written by an American president. Nor is there any doubt of his devotion to the Cincinnatus ideal. As events would verify, this was no whim of the moment. He said nothing on the matter. The 2 handwritten pages were quietly put away. The explosive secret report on the country's military strength, known as NSC 68, paper number 68 of the National Security Council, was ready by the end of the first week in April. Produced primarily by Paul Nitze, under the direction of Dean Acheson, and with the participation of the Defense Department, it was delivered to Truman on April 7th and discussed with him for the first time at a White House meeting of the National Security Council on Tuesday, April 25th. Like the Clifford Elsie memorandum of an earlier day,